Blog Talk Radio.
Today's show is entitled Yahweh's Powerful Relational Name. I am that I am. This name is taken from Exodus chapter. Look at that particular verse shortly. However, I want to provide for you the context of a very rich context in which this particular divine revelation takes place. Let me remind you that we begin in Exodus chapter 1, very interesting statement. It reads, these are the names of the sons of Israel who went to Egypt with Jacob, each with his family: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. The descendants of Jacob numbered 70 in all. Jacob was already in Egypt. Now, the chapter goes on. Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died. But the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceedingly numerous, so that the land was filled with them. And at this point, our time period is around 1700 B.C. Then a new king, who did not know about Joseph, which is very interesting, came to power in Egypt. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become much too numerous for us. Please note carefully the language. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies. Fight against us and leave the country. This is a classic description of a situation in which the people of God are going to pay a heavy price because of the particular view of a politician, of Pharaoh. And he is not really going to talk about the Pharaoh. He's not really going to stop at oppression. He wants to dramatically and radically intervene on the growth of this particular community. And so he puts together a plan for a state-sponsored genocide. Verse 10, come, we must deal shrewdly with them, once again, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. Pharaoh, on his part, needed to secure the northeast frontier. And verse 11 continues, so they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor. And they built Pithom and Ramesses as store cities of Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. So in a Hebrew text, the word for ruthlessly is perek in verse 13. It is a masculine noun, which denotes harshness and intentional cruelty. This word is from a root that means to break apart, or it means to crush with great severity. So, please understand that we're dealing with biblical historiography, and again, our time period is about 1700 BC. But note the timelessness of the message and how it is both it deals with a particular cultural situation, and yet we can take this unique event and look at many others across history. And so we go on. Verse 14. They made their lives bitter with hard labor in brick and mortar, and with all kinds of work in the field. In all their hard labor, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly. Again, it is the word of perek. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah, "When you help the Hebrew women in childbirth, observe them on the delivery stool. If it is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, let her live." The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. Then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, "Why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live?" The midwives answered Pharaoh, "Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive." So God was kind to the midwives and the people of Christ, and the king of mourners. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people: "Every boy that is born, you must throw toward the Nile, but let every girl live." Now, we're in the late Bronze period, which extended from 1500 to 1200 BC. And here of the Pharaoh of this particular situation is Seti. He is the Pharaoh of the oppression. He was the founder of the 19th dynasty from 1305 to 1290 BC. However, the Pharaoh of the Exodus is Ramesses II, from 1290 to 1224. Please note the context in which God is acting in this situation. Notice that God is not going to allow Pharaoh's plan of genocide, to kill the male offspring to go ahead. And Pharaoh had all the power to put the plan in motion. No one's going to resist him. But Pharaoh had not counted on the providence of God in this regard. God is not a part of the plan. God is not in it at all. Now, as we move on, the story narrows. We begin with the general and we move to the specific. And in chapter 2 deals with the birth of Moses, who is going to be born of, whose parents are slaves during this particular period and in this situation. And he is a great boy. And so his existence is illegal. His life is illegal. To let him remain alive illegal is against the word of Pharaoh. And so it would be a capital crime for his parents to let him live. The will of God oftentimes is carried out under very dangerous situations by people who have truly learned to obey God rather than man. And God provides a way for them in the midst of appalling circumstances and situations. So his parents must give him up, and they must release him. In chapter 2, verse 3, we read that when she could hide him no longer because of the genocide order of Pharaoh, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it in the reeds along the bank of the Nile. The sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Now it just so happens, in verse 5, that Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her slave girl to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying, and she felt sorry for him. So Moses is going to the gate in infanticide. She will not be a victim of infanticide. He will be rescued, and he will be pulled or taken from the Nile. And Pharaoh's daughter says, this is one of the Hebrew babies, she said. Then his sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you? Yes, go, she answered. And the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you. So the woman took the baby and nursed him. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, I drew him out of the water. So the hand of God is there in this situation. God has seen, and God knows what is going on with his people and the dire situation under which they live. And so God will provide a deliverer for them. 40 years old in chapter 2, Moses sees something very interesting. We read in verse 11, one day after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard work. And I want you to note the sociology of what is going on here. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people, glancing this way and that, and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid in the sand. The next day, he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew? The man said, who made you ruler and judge? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian? Then Moses was afraid and thought, what I did must have become known. When Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in where he said, down by a well. I want you to know to teach the still theology of slavery and how it is now that when people are oppressed and brutalized, the originators of this particular system have to create the unique circumstances in which start this type of behavior in which people begin to prey upon one another, and their anger, their disappointment, and their bitterness is turned upon each other. Now, I've listened to many shows on what is called black-on-black crime, and how these disenfranchised persons treat one another. And I've also heard very few shows that address the bewildering circumstances that created this type of social control and put in place this type of malevolent milieu. It all began with the Great Society. Hitherto, or before that period, the 40s and 50s, one saw a burgeoning and a growing black community within this country. It was the Great Society, and it was welfareism that moved in and began to unwrap and dismantle the black community, as it were. And so with that, with the part of the home, through welfareism, through controlling persons, through giving them a meager and paltry ways to support themselves, putting in place an intrinsic glass system, glass ceiling, that people would have no way of going up and going out of their situation. Yes, I see why these things are created, and we note the disproportionate number of a black person, within the people of the country, and why this came, how and why this came to pass. So please note what is going on here, what Moses has come to see and understand. And they say to him, verse 14, who made you a ruler and judge of them? Moses is forced to flee. And we read in verse 23, during that long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out in their cry for help. Because of their slavery, went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. Well, that's the English. God was more than concerned about his people. But we'll leave it at that. But, chapter 3 moves on, and we find Moses is a shepherd attending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the far side of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And it was there that the angel of the Lord appeared to him in the flame of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that though the thorn bush, literally, the thorn bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses is at Jebel Musa, and he is here to the Malek Yahweh. And so we have this revelation of God. We read in verse 3, so Moses thought, I will go over to see the strength by why the bush does not burn up. Now, this is indeed a fantastic scene. Here Moses is in the desert tending his father-in-law's sheep, and this is a familiar area, and this thorn bush, I'm sure, was familiar to him. But now there is this unique event in which Moses sees that this thorn bush is on fire, and yet it is not consumed. It's interesting that God chose a thorn bush to represent this unique situation of his people's suffering to Moses. What a very powerful visual lesson. Moses is drawn to this bush. Let's go over it. The strange sight, why the bush does not burn up. So we have a picture here of the people of Israel and their relationship with God. They will go through suffering, but yet the suffering will not consume them. It is also a universal picture of those who belong to God today. They will go through suffering, and yet they are not consumed by what they suffer. When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, here I am. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. Adama Kadosh. Then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. At this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. The Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of that land into a good spacious land, flowing them with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, the Hivites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. So in verse 10, Yahweh says, so now I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And God said, I will be with you, and this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, God of your fathers has sent me to you, let me ask me, what is his name? What's the matter? Then what shall I tell them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am, has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob have sent me to you. This is my name forever, the name by which I am to be remembered from generation to generation." It is interesting that in Hebrew thinking, a name is not merely evocable to distinguish one person from another, but a name is bound with that one, is bound with his. What is his name? And so therefore, to learn a person's name is to enter into a relationship with his very being. Hence the title of our show, Yahweh's powerful relational name, I Am That I Am. Now, this is an idiom in which something is defined in terms of itself. It is used when the speaker does not or cannot be more explicit. It expresses something undetermined or totally or the totality of intensity. I am he who is really and truly present for you, ready to help and to act. Ready to help and to act. And so this wonderful name has been given to Moses by God in a situation in which the people of God are under the rule, under a very oppressive and deliberately destructive regime that wants to keep them in spiritual squalor, a regime that will not allow them to experience any type of relief, but to keep their spirits burdened and controlled and submissive, fear through the negation of their, etc. God sees this. And God has prepared man for this situation. And God will address what has been done to them in a very compelling manner. And we're going to be able to take a look into the psychology of power and how power, when resisted, is going to meet resistance with power. Always going to meet the power that will fight against him with greater power. And even in the face of overwhelming power, entrenched power will attempt to overcome that which it knows that it cannot overcome. But it will nevertheless attempt to assuage the situation in which it finds itself. And so, in this contest, Pharaoh is going to lose dramatically. But in his mind, it's God. And we're going to take a look at that. And what that is going to be to Pharaoh's situation. My name is Pastor Simon. I will speak with you next time on the matter.